whooping glass everywhere. People pissing on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are. This is Punkonomics, broadcasting live from WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. And just a quick reminder that all opinions stated here today are solely ours, not of the staff at Rollins College or the staff at WPRK.
Not just today, in general.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Dr. Balak.
Yeah, that'll be me. Benny Balak. We have a guest today. We planned it kind of in the last minute, but then the last minute got even more last minute. So with us after a long time not being on the show, is Joe Seery, who's a professor of, in the environmental studies program here at Rollins.
Hey, Ben.
We got you there on the, just a minute. There's like, you know, we're always, you know how it is. We start kind of, you know, rushing about and switching buttons and, or at least Jesse does. That's one of the reasons why, I don't dare handle the technology myself. Yet it's got a lot of, improvisation involved. But, here we are. You see, it's like running and this and there he is. So, Joe's with us and we had a couple of things, being an environmentalist, environmental, studies professor, he obviously had, things related to the environment. And then of course the news kind of caught us last night with terrible tragedy in Paris. So we kind of, and we talk a lot about these things on the show. So it's kind of, you know, calls to say something about it. Of course, to the extent that we know it's, we'll poke at that, at this nasty topic a little bit, certainly. And then we're going to segue a little bit, in the context of these conflicts, in the context of the Middle East. So help me remember, as I'm recovering from this really nasty little virus that's been running around. I've been really sick for 3 days. Students happy. I mean, not in a mean way, just surely to get a little bit of a couple of days off there. To catch up to their work. But we will bring in the environmental angle. We were just having a quick chat kind of, at how to, you know, not put things together. We don't put things together, but to how to break them apart, right? But I wanted to start with something perhaps minute, as I cannot really get any kind of internet access right now, but from memory, therefore. When I logged into Facebook, at some point, kind of in small hours of the night, I got this this notification kind of embedded into the feed of all the people who are my friends who are in Paris and that they're safe. You know, except for one that didn't record that she's safe. But frankly, that's one of those people that are Facebook friends, but you don't really know who they are. So, you know, that's the nature of the beast a little bit, right?
Sure.
As Gary Newman asked with the Two-Way Army back in 1979, are friends electric?
Yes.
How prescient is that? Not only did he invent electronic music, along with Kraftwerk, but we're off topic. So anyway, yeah, the only people that I couldn't find out about like that automatically were people, of course, who were private enough or discreet enough not to put where they live or if they weren't in the city. So, I mean, it's not perfect, but it's I don't know, you know, it was a good tool.
But the country's still on lockdown, do we?
I don't even know. Again, my parents are there and they're very old and their problems are health problems. Frankly, they're not really experiencing too much difficulties with that other than, you know, my mom going to take care of my dad using a taxi instead of a bus or metro. Just to avoid,
I think they still are in lockdown.
Some areas.
Well, I thought actually.
And the nation.
Air travel in and out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering because I have a friend who's actually declared as being on his way, back, home. So I don't know exactly. Right, if anybody's out there, you know, waiting at the airport, having his flight delayed. Of course, there's no direct flights from Orlando. But, I mean, that would be taken care of pretty quickly. I mean, it's a matter of manhunt and such, but they've killed them all pretty much. So, I mean, I don't think they probably have a lot to work with.
Is that the latest?
That they know of.
There's one person in Belgium. I mean, you know how it is. I mean, that's almost something to avoid. That's all the trees and you don't see the forest a little bit, isn't it? So it kind of distracts almost, which, so what, they arrested somebody in Belgium, so maybe they helped them. There was some dude who was caught in Britain, maybe on the way to France. Again, all of those things are, you know, important for the police, surely, but maybe not for the big picture. So it's a, you know, it's a pretty big terrorist attack. It's not 9/11, but it's what it'll end with, 200 people dead probably and a couple of hundred injured, and you know, oops, sorry, that was me. You know how it is. So definitely a terrible tragedy.
And in a way, it's a double tragedy, not to make what happened any less of a horrible event, but everyone is going to Paris for the United Nations COP discussion on climate, and so this will hang heavily on everyone, from the NGOs who go to the. It's somewhat like in the old days, a fair, a medieval fair, where people who are trying to promote their own energy efficiency or water efficiency, you name it, it's sort of an environmental gathering for the Council of the Parties, who are going to negotiate further restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions. So, and in fact, I think Gore had planned to say something last night in a what has become an annual series of talks before these Council of the Parties called the COP meetings, and that was interrupted, of course.
We want to make the link. I mean, let me stay in this dark spirit of this time.
Sure, we should. And, yeah, and no, it's very sad.
Paris was predicted to be a complete waste of time and failure anyway.
Yes, there is those who see it that way, of course.
So tell us in what sense. I mean, of course, we won't get a binding commitment by the necessary players, and we won't get anything near enough, but tell us the positive. You know, I mean, what can come out of Paris? We will not get what we would love to and we'd need, we absolutely desperately need, no doubt, but do we get anything out of it? I know that's a tricky question. It's easier to criticize, sadly.
Well, there is the consistent divide between those nations who want the technology and need the assistance that they claim, and it isn't really their claim. It's the fact that studies have shown that it's the poor and the developing nations that are going to suffer the worst in the coming years, and are now. We shouldn't argue that it's not happening now. And I don't mean just the issue of what some people think of as rising sea levels or changes in water availability or soil moisture, but more to the point, large sections of Africa that are dry and have been dry for the last several decades are places that are going to need technology transfer. And in thinking about today's discussion, I went back, and it's almost 10 years ago that the Stern Commission report from Britain came out, and it said very clearly that the poor, so we've been waiting 9 years to get something done, and it hasn't
turning
happened.
Around
and
in
I
circle.
Think that's the frustration. Basically, Obama, though, has made I think progress with the Chinese and some progress with the Brazilians. The question becomes, those are very large developing nations, of course, who in the last 10 years, we've always pointed the finger before Obama came into the White House. We'd point the finger at these negotiations and treaties and protocols and say, oh, well, what if the Chinese don't sign on? Or what if the Brazilians don't sign on? We're just wasting our time. They're big polluters. They're cutting down lots of forest. And the Chinese are building, I don't know, a crazy thing, coal plant every day. I doubt that's the case. But
they're slowing down, though. So
exactly. So I don't think we can use that any longer. I don't know that we're going to get any agreement. The Saudis have always wanted not to see too much agreement on these issues. Also in preparation for this, you and I were talking before, the amount of subsidies of the G20 to oil, gas, and coal.
So we're talking about the 20 richest countries in the world.
So
it's a pretty broad club. It's not just the usual suspects, the really rich, the G8. If you have,
that's right. Not just the United States, but Britain,
industrial,
France,
more
Germany.
Or less industrial, upper middle to high income countries. Right. Yeah.
And they subsidize fossil fuel use, coal, natural gas, and oil, up to $456 billion a year. Yeah. To companies that are already profitable. So I think.
Extremely so. In fact, record-breaking profitable. literally record-breaking
so.
Profitable.
Right. Well, they make billions, and I think I saw something of roughly $300 and some million was spent by oil companies alone on lobbying Congress.
Yeah, it's a really shockingly unknown topic. So when we, people talk about, even if you are, I think incorrectly, maybe I'm wrong, concerned with fiscal rectitude, your pro austerity, you want low, you're particularly concerned about the effects of a budget deficit. I don't know. I don't buy that, but let's put that aside for a moment. If that is one's position, more on the conservative, right-wing side of macroeconomics, you should. If you want to cut the budget, don't look at food stamps and pregnant women food support, because that's not even a thousandth of a percent of the amount of money that we're giving highly profitable oil companies that don't need that money, that can perfectly well conduct their operations without it, right, out of the tax pool.
And they're making billions. It's shocking. I guess
huge chunk of our tax bill. Like those things where you can kind of cut. Sure, military is huge. Yes, that's very shocking. Right. Social Security is big, right, but the top league includes that. Right. Literally, like old school central government supporting, and it doesn't matter, by the way, Republican, Democrats, it's absolutes.
And this is anecdotal, but here's an example of the fact that the military's recognition of this problem, in the sense of, if you look at the number of deaths in Afghanistan, mm-hmm, American servicemen who die there. This was Veterans Week, of course, because of the commemoration of the end of the First World War on November 11th at 11 a.m., the armistice being signed. And so it got me to thinking something that's very important. The supply lines, the people who protect the supply lines for oil and mm-hmm, gas, mm-hmm, coming into fuel U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, the casualty rates are highest per capita among that group of people who are trying to protect the supply line to make sure that trucks and motor vehicles have sufficient oil and gas.
So they are targeted.
And they're targeted, of course. Targeted. So why wouldn't they? Because,
or otherwise.
Sure. Well, the lesson of the Nazi occupation of Russia is, if you get their supply lines, they can't run their tanks.
When the war turned around, when the Germans started losing, is when the Russians didn't let them get Stalingrad.
Ran out of gas.
That's where the gas was,
so to speak.
Yeah.
So I think in many ways, a simple answer to your question isn't easy, because that is, what can we expect from Paris? You've got corporations that are already making profit off of the existing situation, no matter what Obama might want to do, or probably John Kerry, probably the most intelligent on climate change Secretary of State we've had. Is Kerry.
Because on foreign policy, he makes Clinton look good.
Yes, we got some serious issues here. But that's what complicates this, is the United States isn't one purpose, it seems to me, and the multinational corporations that require fossil fuels and have a military ability to have the military secure those lines for them, no matter if it does.
And that's probably not counted, by the way, in your $450 billion a year support.
Not at all. Yeah,
that would quadruple that. I mean, if we counted of all the dirty work that enlisted men and women do,
the naval
not fleet. For the national interest, but for very specific narrow economic interest, and very significantly for the, fossil fuel industry, then that would, count all that damage, all the death, all the misery, all the injuries, that the number would shoot up. It's often, by the way, underestimated, the veteran cost long term. We're still paying for all those you know, right. poor, broken kids from Vietnam today that's still that's eating right. at our budget, all still today.
And we don't actually, it's interesting, we don't hear anything about the Veterans Administration anymore, yeah. as if it got, immediately got cleaned up and changed,
right.
and things are better now, so... Maybe that would be an interesting program to have some veterans on. And
yeah, yeah, we've used the some VA info. We could, yeah, that's actually yeah, that's an invite for you, Jesse, because you fought for your dad's rights against. Because I hear enough people complain, because you know I don't listen to mainstream media. I listen to a very peculiar bunch, whatever, for what it's worth. So I've heard a lot of people complain about veteran affairs and continue to complain about it. Before the scandal broke and continues right. today, but Jesse has a personal story that at some point, I mean, I don't know if it's our primary. I don't know when it comes around because the details are interesting.
Well, I mean, Veterans Affairs is, you know, pretty much subject to the media that the Obama administration wants to spin. And, you know, it's like everything else. You can put some really nice curtains at a window, but it doesn't mean that when you open them up, you're going to find something. Mm-hmm. And that's basically it's been through every administration. Mm-hmm. So far.
Yeah, it's again, it doesn't matter the administration on these things. And really, I mean, you're hard pressed to find a topic on which the so-called two-party system runs is on this kind of you know on the
or is it
imperial
the
military-based
system?
Economic right. model that's the full
oh,
agreement.
Of course, yeah. Well, there's an agreement, but is it a 2.5-party system now?
I think it's barely a one. Quite frankly, I like I have a little shtick about it, right? To use the Yiddish vernacular here. It's that we have less
right.
democracy, less difference between Democrats and Republicans today. Sure, there are always those marginal voices within the party that are pushing them in somewhat different direction, whether it be the Ron Paulian and the libertarian branch of Republicans or now Republicans really fragmented. They have like old normal Republicans and, you know, the new cuckoo Republicans.
Abnormal Republicans.
All of that stuff. So it's much more fragmented, no doubt.
Fundamentalism, right?
Democrats are now getting there. Democrats are also getting a little bit of fragmentation, which is very healthy and purifying for them, I think, via Bernie Sanders. So
it is from the
we have those
the Vermont perspective.
But otherwise, the general mainstream party, as has it been de facto, including Obama, the policy that it enacts is similar. Well, the shtick is that consider the reformists and old guard in the Communist Party Politburo, like in the darkest days, like of the 70s, the Brezhnevian kind of, you know, black and white horror. they were arguing on more substantially different perspectives
the
back
Russians.
Then, let alone when finally Gorbachev, you know, won since the 50s when Khrushchev tried and failed. So Gorbachev won this kind of, we want a non-dictatorial state-operated nightmare. We want, as he called it at the time, socialism with a democratic socialism with a human face.
With a stone.
Or along, you know,
with a smile.
With a smile.
like in Western Europe, or like in America in large sense at the time, even in the Reagan times, by to compare to today.
Yeah. Social democracy, yeah.
Yeah. So those are more substantial arguments that are happening between the two main parties. So I'm just putting to you that they had elections too, didn't they? You know, very, it was meaningless, of course, just as meaningless as ours.
It's like the Syrian elections, right?
Right. Oh, we'll have an election, that'll solve the problem. Libya had an election, the death camps are still functioning, you know, Iraq had an election, we see how wonderful that's
well, they're just going through the motions, it's kind of like...
it's a ritual.
Ritual. Like the Columbus Parade
yeah.
in New York, you know. why are they still doing it? Who knows?
But it's hard to stop the pretending. But you know what? Like, go back to the context of environmentalism. Something kind of reminded me that you talked about the State Department, or actually I think in this case it's going to be the Pentagon, the Stern
Pentagon
report
has
in 2005.
Done it. Right.
They are talking about it, right? About the
Pentagon
the risk,
is
the security risks of the
serious about the fact that it's not only, well, first of all, climate change is happening now. Mm-hmm. In the Arctic, whole villages are being moved because of the melting of the permafrost. Native American villages, First Nations peoples are being moved because of, not so much in being in harm's way in the issue of, a tidal wave coming over them or something, but as the Arctic melts and, their traditional sources of fishing and hunting are altering, the villages have to be moved, whether it be for erosion purposes or the fact that the ground is just sinking.
These are our own refugees.
Yes, we don't hear much about the Inuit and the Yupik people, but so there's the government is committed to moving their villages for safety's sake. But the Pentagon, more interestingly enough, of course, is beginning to deploy things like solar, photovoltaic energy, especially when we're talking about the supply lines for oil having to be heavily protected in a forward situation. So you'll see in the marine bases around the world, especially in Afghanistan where the sunlight is. You're even closer to the sun, aren't you?
No, we live
in Florida. 10,000, 12,000 feet or something. So, yeah. But you'll see a lot of, to especially running radio equipment or, this is a sort of, a sad commentary too. But if one is serious about the fact that terrorism is a threat worldwide and globally, then aren't your oil and gas lines? And for that matter, your reservoirs and your aqueducts, very vulnerable. But if everybody had their own solar electric power.
All big systems are vulnerable.
All big systems are.
Like my favorite right winger, actually. My favorite right wing thinker is Nassim Taleb. And he writes really wonderfully about esoteric, like, statistical aspects, but really well. So that's really cool. But at any rate, he has this notion of precisely in studying systems to make the distinction between, this book actually is fragile and anti-fragile.
Yes.
Systems that are fragile, that crises make them more fragile,
and
you know, brittle and ready to collapse, like our economy.
Well, that too, right? And electrical systems more than almost anything. Mm-hmm. As you know, in Florida, we know when there's hurricanes, or in New Orleans, when the electricity goes, you have no water, you have no gasoline, you have,
no air conditioning.
You have, everybody swelters.
Yeah.
No heat in the Northeast when there's a terrible storm.
Heat, you can always. I don't know.
No, I'm thinking when you get those cold storms in the Northeast and the power goes out because of the tree limbs falling on exposed wires, people could actually freeze to
ice
death.
Storm.
So, but if you had your own distributive power, the likelihood of you not surviving through a tragedy, you're much better off. But we have centralized everything and, we're one step away from the inevitable, which is what happens when the system, as you suggested, collapses. And I think you're right to make the analogy between, sure, there's electrical engineering and there's electrical and gas delivery systems. But then, of course, the economy is one of those fragile systems. Yeah. And the more we keep relying on, unrenewable, resources, I think the bigger the damage in the future. The Stern, we mentioned the Stern report earlier. They said the longer we wait, the worse it's going to be.
Sure.
And of course we've waited 9 years.
Yeah, 10 years since then. You're right. I mean, now the argument, you know, it's very frustrating, no doubt about it. But sometimes even though we like to point out, you know, and at least I know, I like to point out the annoying little nagging kind of crazy stuff. It goes without saying that we are facing now, we are in a catastrophe situation. Now the question is, how horrible is it going to be? The notion of climate change denial is really beyond the ridiculous. But.
It's almost pernicious.
It's a state of denial
is
that is psychotic
people.
At this point. I mean, literally.
Right. But it hurts people to be psychotic.
Murders more people than anything else.
Right.
No doubt about it. But again, it's not in the Hollywoodian dramatic, giant tidal wave, freeze storm, you know, the thing that makes a good action movie. It's in the insurance companies for, you know, raising premiums and impoverishing everybody, eventually unable to insure, and then capitalism is over.
And no reinsurance.
The day after.
Right.
That's finished. and the amount of death and suffering that it generates, including, like you were asking me, if I was aware of something that so many people aren't aware of, you're absolutely right, of the role of water shortages in the Middle East. So, and specifically, you mentioned the current, very recent situation that pushed a lot of rural migrants from drought, areas into the cities in Syria, specifically
Syrian situation.
Adding the temperature a little bit to an already fragile situation. and being part of the Sparks. And I, you know, I heard about that, but I also know from being from the area that, that we all know this kind of thing, that actually it's all about water. It's not about oil, certainly in the Middle East.
Well, water scarcity is, runs almost like a, well, there's some bad puns here, almost like a garden hose through this entire problem, you know, but to be more pedestrian, what's striking, and you and I have talked about this before, is that there are some people who argue that, the Arab Spring issue, partially is the price of food. Going up dramatically.
It's never one thing. I mean, that's the thing. We shouldn't say.
Multiple causes.
Yeah, the extra
right.
economic pressure. The same could be said in history for about the French Revolution.
Of course.
The American Revolution,
sure.
the English Revolution, any revolution almost. You have to have that extra squeeze where people are, you know, the future is uncertain.
Right. And at the base of the food, of course, is this fact of, well, what are we paying for the water and where's the water coming from? Mm-hmm. And what's striking about the Syrian, although I don't think we should limit it to the Syrian situation, as many of us argue with Darfur and the breakup of Sudan, is a persistent drought in the
another episode we were all you know duped into
and,
talking about, and by it's a catastrophe, by the way.
And it is, and of course, well, but let's put it this way: if the Vatican can understand that this is an ethical and moral problem, and arguably it's a new pope, but if the Vatican can understand this, it strikes me that not only is the denial of climate, but the inability to see the connections between international disruption and failed states.
And the Pentagon, I think it was the Pentagon. Excuse me if I'm wrong. Maybe it was CIA analyst, but I'm pretty sure there was a talk about the specific role of, I mean, official statement about the specific role of environmental change and damage and problems with security.
Well, food security and water security
and
are
therefore
essential.
Security in the sense
and,
of...
And then military security,
right,
course,
I mean, it's, what's going on in the Middle East now is a result of a lot of things, but what's fueling it is that there is no future.
Or the future is in the city. If we go back full circle to your idea of systems, I'm
in
reminded
Syria specifically.
Not only Syria, but one could argue that the entire course of civilization was that people were once grazing and farming people, but moved into these cities because of adverse climate conditions, lack of water, lack of seasonability of rain. But what's striking to me is I'm reminded that Mao's argument during the Chinese Revolution was that we just starve the cities. We just surround the cities and we starve them. And what we're seeing is a another vulnerable system. And yeah, you certainly aren't going to take Syrians out of the city and put them back into, where would you put them? I mean, it's more desert now than before, same as in Darfur.
A similar situation going on in Mexico as we speak. Right?
Well, I'm thinking Mexico, California, Nevada, Arizona. What we're seeing is
that's also what's driving
a limitation to how much water you can deliver, you could argue. But I think an important thing for the listeners to think about is that you can't have water without oil. You can't have oil without water. People say they don't mix, but when you think about it, if you don't have energy, there's no water running into your house. There's no water being delivered to California vegetables because it has to be pumped. Whether it's pumped over hills or underground, you've got to pump it. And as soon as the electricity goes, which is, how do we get electricity? Well, the electricity is either coal or it's oil. In some
places. I was shocked, I remember, to find out. I think it's under 50% finally because it's really fallen a lot recently, and it's great. But I was so shocked a few years ago to find that America's electricity is over 50% from coal.
Yeah.
Once again, I remember going from Western Europe to Eastern Europe when it opened up, like, you know, in 89 and 90, in the early day. One of the first things that, is that it was like Dickens's London. this nasty local pollution of that coal dust lying over the city that is heated with coal.
Yeah, especially Poland, I would think.
Czechoslovakia. Yeah, everywhere, really.
Yeah,
everywhere, locally at least. Then there were areas, of course, that were like, the northern Czech Republic and Poland, with border with Poland, is like lunar scape, landscape.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah, exactly. So,
which is one of the things of the environment, right? That when you're talking about Paris and the kind of the big players, the big polluters, much of what the poor world claims correctly that we spent the last 250 years industrializing and building up mass amounts of capital that is what's under what's making us rich and comfortable and free and all those wonderful things. We created all this mass amount of damage, and now we can afford to be cleaner, but they need to industrialize. So there's a imbalance in requiring poorer countries to industrialize cleanly, while we didn't have to. We just destroyed not only our local resources in whatever our, you know, West, you know, Europe, America,
ever-expanding West,
but also stripping the resources of the rest of the world and shipping it over.
Yeah, Nigerian oil or Venezuelan oil or Mexican oil. What's striking is
for 500 years
is we've been taking tons, right, of either liquid or solid carbon and turning it into gas, and it's now half of it in the ocean, causing it to become acidic, and the rest of it sitting in the atmosphere. This year was the record, 400 parts per million. Usually pretty meaningless term for most listeners, but when you think about it, it's in the last, we haven't seen this level of carbon dioxide in the air in a million years, and so that means we've never seen it. Civilization has never seen it. And that's the other problem. You can't see it. You know, it's colorless, it's odorless, but it's there. The temperatures, and the acidity in the ocean suggest to us that we have done this. Another thing to point out to folks who are climate deniers, isotopes don't lie. Right? The carbon isotope ratio just clearly shows that this comes from combustion, and it's combustion of, as you suggested, the coal that France, England, and eventually the United States and Germany used to industrialize, the oil that was secured in the 20th century to make sure that we had sufficient naval power, and for that matter, Henry Ford. We could thank Henry Ford, but somebody ought to thank the Rockefellers for the oil that went into the cars that now are sort of strikingly a problem for us. So I think you're absolutely right about this issue of we've done it. Now we're telling all of the other countries, you can't do it this way. But we're not providing them, and this is, I think, a sticking point in Paris, we're not providing them with the energy technology transfer that is needed.
Oh, we're not. I mean, you're being nice, and that's fine. You know, it's great. Somebody
we're
has
screwing
to be.
Them. No,
I mean, it's not just 500 years. Our entire development was based on, you know, the kidnapping of people and the. Not that it belittles the accomplishment of Western civilization, by the way, but part of the West becoming so successful, taking over the world, doing a lot of horrible things.
You mean the last 500 years?
I'm not being this kind of complete bleeding heart, but I'm just recognizing the fact that we wouldn't have had this industrialization, the standard of living, the ability to raise the middle class to levels that are compatible with a free kind of somewhat democratic market system, you know, you can't argue in a large sense with a 250 years record of improvement in standard of living for a significant, not complete, but a significant chunk of the population. A very partial success, but a success that I accept. Absolutely.
But in the sense that twenty million Africans brought to the new world.
Extermination of the population of the new world.
Oh, eradication of Native
Africa,
peoples.
Asia, India, taking a country that was centuries ahead, you know, and destroying it on purpose, very meticulously. Destroying their economy. It's not that they didn't have that. They had the capital. We burnt it.
We didn't want them to.
No competition.
No Indian textiles, no Indian shipbuilding,
killing millions in the process.
Yes.
And sometimes in very awful, kind of very difficult to argue that it was a mistake ways, shall we say. In India, by the way.
Not just that, but, and why not be able to sell opium to the Chinese?
Right.
Whether they want it or not.
Clever. In a sense, how you take over already decaying empire, give it a nice push. So all of those things are just kind of facts of history, and we should be careful not to fall into identity politics. So are you a hater of the West and defender of the, or are you? No.
That's too simplistic.
I am a man of the West.
Right,
I just realized the reality of what happened. And what do we do now? Like, right? That's it. And here, like you said, that brings back to conflict, right? Especially as conflicts will, as the Pentagon, I think it was the Pentagon, and many others knew that the climate change might not bring the waters up within our generation immediately, but they will cause horrific, epochal pain, suffering, death. And they already are.
And the refugee crisis. They already are. Yes. I mean, the fact that we still have a notion that refugees have to be political refugees of a certain kind, actually. So you can't really say to yourself, and I guess the people in New Zealand and Australia have already tried to stop the Pacific Islanders from claiming that people are refugees from environmental disasters.
Yeah.
But that doesn't give you status. You have to, you have to have like Castro after you before you can come into the United States and actually run for president, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure.
That's
but
useful.
Some refugees can run for president, I think.
It's harder for me to leave my region. I didn't have a claim. I still don't have a claim.
So what we need to do, there's a lot of catch up to do, but one of those areas of catch up is to be able to declare displaced people. For whatever reason, but especially for reasons of due to drought or flooding or disaster.
But we still continue to live in the. So I did a little kind of a short mea culpa kind of for the West Passage right now, right? About those horrible 500 years. It's the beginning of, you know, from Columbus till the end of colonization. But what about the last, what about since
last
World War
II? Last 50 years?
I'd like to remind
levels,
people that we're actually, sure, we don't, first of all, in the past decade, we've gone back to, you know, having troops on the ground all over the planet. And when I say we, again, I'm very broadly the powerful of this world. You know, the Russians are in this game now too. Of course, the Europeans have always been kind of, you know, the junior assistants of the most powerful country in the world, which is the United States. Of course, the Chinese are not so much militarily, but in other ways, you know, big powers. But right now, the old colonial powers, that would be the old European countries. And again, I don't want to, you know, poke France when it's
France
down.
And
it's
United
where they have
Kingdom.
All my love and everything. But the French policy has been sucking to the tune of many billions of euros a year out of their impoverished, war-stricken ex-colonies. So the destruction of the active destruction of the poor world, which leaves them typically with very little, either become locally corrupt and try and, you know, backstab and get what they can or cooperate with whoever's raiding their country, or go off the grid, you know, become Somali pirates, for example, right? The Somali pirates don't need no help. They're excellent fishermen. The problem is that we've destroyed their fish, so they have no other option, yes?
Industrial fishing
but
is ruining the
fisheries. But in America, people don't
fisheries.
Talk about it except for South Park.
I mean,
that's
exactly,
a
right,
horrific
right.
irony. The only place where the whole...
is our cartoons. That, and we should remind people that Syria was a French colony, of course. And so what we're seeing is... You could argue that it's still colonialism, but we just changed the name.
It's neocolonialism, post-colonialism.
Exactly. And so what we're seeing is a kind of bankruptcy of that whole approach, which you're saying is, I think, fairly important for us to realize that in the last 50 years, the level of consumption, perhaps not so much in France, Britain, and Germany, and certainly not in the Soviet sector, but the United States consumption of energy is three times the rate of population growth, water twice the rate of population growth. We consume, 25% of the world's resources, and we're 4% of the world's population and falling.
Here's a question for you. Is it people basically they just are wasteful, or is it that we're not energy efficient?
I think it's both. I think it's the energy efficiency gains are tremendous. An example, apparently, that somebody points out in DuPont alone, there's a New Jersey plant where they saved about 1/3 of their energy use per pound of product. So, corporations are beginning to recognize energy efficiency is important. But I think for most of us who are, whether you be urban residents or suburban residents, especially suburban residents, you're at the mercy of are there bus routes that serve you? Would you take a bus anyhow? The shocking thing about not just here on I-4, but if you look at Los Angeles, the number of people still in one car.
Mm-hmm.
I used to love the Drew Carey show because it was the only show that started out with a bunch of people in a car.
Carpooling together,
you know. But what does it take to get people to carpool?
But you know, it's a great question. This is such an important issue that you're mentioning. I mean, sure, it's both, but it's a weird dynamic.
It is very weird.
We're constantly talking about the private, right, the individual reaction, right? So stop drinking bottle. Well, I mean, stop doing the egregiously, like, you know, commuting in L.A. alone, living there. Yeah.
Takes Larry David.
A lot of people do it.
Of course, it takes Larry David to show the irony of that.
But that hides that, you know, that would have been a necessary component, but frankly a secondary one. Right? I mean, we have to look at the big systemic things, the other that Jesse was asking about, right? I mean, even just our suburban way of living makes absolutely no sense.
And the waste that comes with it because, well, there may be other states, but one thing California did as far as its energy sale policy is that, and in Florida we're not doing this, and that is, You make money in a utility, whether it be Duke or Florida Power and Light, by having people use more energy. So of course you want them to have the air conditioner on all the time. Of course you want them to be driving their car. You're making more money.
The incentives are completely skewed.
Right. And so what they did in California is to change it to, well, the company, Pacific Gas and Electric is going to make money if it encourages conservation of energy, where people will either go off the grid or at least dump their solar power onto the grid and get some money back for it. Florida doesn't have that.
No. You're describing policy, sound policy, and you know, of course that policy you have to be careful not to, because I, to put my right winger hat on, you know.
Well, I was going
to
say even a libertarian would like the fact that house should, why can't a small home make something other than consume all the time?
Right.
And what it could make, of course, is on its roof. Then the Germans do this, right? They've turned the roof into an asset. My roof is a cost to me because I have to put shingles back on.
But again, I can't afford. I looked into it. I cannot economically afford. I have to be in the top, I don't know, 10% of the, at least, if not 5% of the wealth distribution to even consider reasonably to do solar panels.
Right.
Not 1%, actually, probably. Before it makes any kind of reasonable sense, right?
Well, the first people I ever met in Florida, some almost 20 years ago, were a Republican couple who lived in what I call the Republican coast, the southwest part of Florida. Mm-hmm. And I just asked, and I said, geez, you have solar? They came up to us, you know, I said, oh yeah, they had solar power. And they said, oh, of course, it just makes so much sense. But of course, they're, you know, 1/10 of 1%
of a free marketeer would be a true libertarian or a true reasonable
you'd be renting roofs putting up solar panels.
You gotta give me some kind of leasing. I mean, there's there could be, when I hear an argument from the best arguments from the right are the arguments of saying here's a way to use it with minimal government bureaucratic interference, but I'm addressing the issue. Then I that puts a smile on my face. Maybe especially when I disagree,
Well, it's good to have people disagree.
This is a productive argument.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
right.
So absolutely right. I mean, so how can you in a straight face support, you know, these oil companies that are receiving kind of subsidies like a Soviet Union level, basically public companies, and it, oh, sorry. And nervously scratching the microphone post. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay.
And at the same time, we support monopolies. No, on the contrary, absolutely. I think Floridians should all have a publicly supplied or leased, so we can pay it back off the profits. Power.
Well, as you know, even in we were told even 5 years ago in a visit to Israel, you can't build a new, even though the settlements are being created, but you can't build anything new in Israel unless you have solar hot water.
Well, everybody had solar there since, primitive solar, just hot water, right?
Yeah, just
right?
hot water,
but
because they have
the
these 60s, huge plants
no
producing electricity.
Nobody
right.
had anything but.
Exactly. But here in Florida, where it would be natural to have solar hot water in the mortgage of every house. Mm-hmm. And again, another a good example of this from the west coast of Florida was a Republican member of a county commission who said to me, there needs to be a state law that says some percentage of all new construction is going to have either, well, certainly solar thermal. That's called, that's where you heat your hot water. We all know how hot the hose is in the summer if you've got a southern exposure. You scald yourself. And the notion that you're going to use coal-fired electricity, right, bringing coal all the way down from Kentucky or God knows Wyoming after you've strip mined the hell out of the place so that you can heat up your water.
As
take
I like
a shower
to confuse,
in the summer
you know,
is part of that
it
ridiculousness.
It looks just like the ridiculous stories my granddad used to tell about the old communist countries. That's how we look with a lot of consumer goods from China. But in many ways, on the big, important, long-term issues, yeah. And I so don't want this country to look like the Soviet at its end days.
Well,
and,
our infrastructure,
or Russia today,
our infrastructure
frankly.
Already looks a little like the Soviet.
It's so shocking.
There was this big deal, right, that they made. What is it, last week or something? Or maybe they didn't pass this. But Paul Ryan saying, "Oh, we finally got a transportation bill." It's not a good transportation bill. It's just a steady as you go, which is letting bridges collapse and things like this. But the gasoline tax doesn't even pay for this crap. Infrastructure.
Come on, give him a beep. Give him a beep.
Yeah, we shouldn't talk that way. Shouldn't talk that way. But I was thinking of the crap shoot that one could argue that you're right. It's funny what we have deregulated, right? We've deregulated airlines. I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, no, right? Actually, no, we re-regulated them, but badly.
Badly re-regulated
again.
Them,
yeah,
right?
And
we give large amounts of subsidies to coal, oil, and gas.
It's already regulated,
nuclear.
Right? We give the instead of policing the market to ensure competition, which is an absolutely necessary, what's the fancy word, sine qua non, you know, condition for capitalism to function.
And that's what the Interstate Commerce Commission
was created
for.
We give all the power to monopolies, to private monopolies, right. to offer a shoddy product for high prices. Once again, you know, let's wave the red flag. But this is not Obama, anybody who just tuned in, you know. This is, on the contrary, this is the corporate elite that control both parties, it's comfortable for them, just like it was for the apparatchiks, members of the Communist Party back in the quote-unquote good old days.
Well, speaking of that control, this was shocking, and I trust The Daily Show, but the new Daily Show.
Oh God, I haven't watched it.
Oh, you got Noah. Well, he did the dictionary. Noah Webster. But anyhow, the new guy, 158 families was the latest are bankrolling the Republican.
Concentrated
people running for office in the Republican Party. 158 families.
But how
are the lion's share of that money that's going to
the Democrats shouldn't be much different. I mean, the Democrats have this game they played already with Obama, this notion of, oh, there's so many people giving this.
Small little people.
Yeah, but all together.
Right. Small little donations.
1% little of the donations.
I don't know if that, yeah.
That bespeaks to the popular support, absolutely, but it doesn't speak to who then owns him.
Who's
afterwards.
Actually, giving it.
As we've discovered.
And you want to follow the money in both parties, of course.
Republicans are better at it. You got to give them that.
But when I heard that the number, I was just thinking to myself, I was hoping it was like 500, but even that's ridiculous.
Yeah, but they
all
agree.
A country of 30 million. But let's go back to your point about what's happened to democracy. There's a wonderful metric that you can find that has to do with the number of representatives in the House of Representatives, right? And the number of people they represent. And what we have seen happening with the growth of population is the country, even when it had slaves, was more democratic in a sense that fewer numbers of people were represented by a member of Congress. But now a member of Congress represents nearly a million people or more in some places. So you don't have – how are they going to even know 50,000 people in their constituency?
And do they really care?
And would they care?
I think it's a big country. I mean, even smaller countries, it's
have
very
more
difficult
members.
To be direct.
Okay. Well, right, but they even have more members of, I would think, of the popular House. But what we've seen happening since about 1900 is the gradual, one might say, is that you have more and more large numbers of constituents being represented by fewer.
Yeah.
Representatives and in that sense it reinforces the lobbyists, it reinforces those companies and people who get access. And so one would hope that the Pentagon and CIA can recognize climate change problems, because you're not going to get it from people who are pursuing their own self-interest and already getting a good deal on the current system.
Right. It's very difficult. And again, right. I mean, if you happen to be fortunate enough to be in the ruling classes, you know, I can understand, but we have to put ourselves in those shoes. Consider maybe if I was like some, you know, Count de je ne sais quoi in the Ancien Régime, would have pretty good reason to worry significantly with the rising revolutionary fervor coming out of Paris. And it would be difficult. A few people should be celebrated for having been in that position and decided to be on the right side of history, right? They betrayed their own class for the benefit of their fellow countrymen.
You mean the Franklin Roosevelt type thing?
Well, that's maybe a little bit more mild. I'm thinking precisely of aristocrats supporting the, you know,
French Revolution.
French Revolution, exactly. Or aristocrats support, like Tolstoy famously in the Russian Revolution. Adam Smith, a lot of people don't know that he died in full support of the French Revolution. Though he died in 1789, so I guess
it looked good in 1789 before
it wonderful
the terror.
but okay, listen, top of the hour, that might be a good time to do that top of the hour thing.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah? All
what's
right.
The top of the hour thing?
That's the rules.
That's the rules.
same rules like we beeped you a moment ago.
Don't say bad words.
Yeah, well, or get beeped. It's all right.
Views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect...